It's usually the first question after an introduction. Oh, hi, hello, nice to meet you. And then, what do you do? For some people, the answer is easy. A single word can cover the activities that may take up more of our time than anything else. But the meaning of all this work, or maybe the lack of work, that can be much more difficult to articulate. That's where our next guest comes in. He leads conversations about the meaning of work all over Oregon, unpacking what do you do to reveal more of who you are. He's had more than a few job experiences to draw on. Construction worker, backcountry trail crew leader, waiter, burrito vendor, teacher, counselor, and these days, the director of a statewide nonprofit organization, Oregon Humanities. Today, his work is to be our guest. Adam Davis, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks very much, Emily. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. So it's pretty tempting to ask right off the bat, what do you do? But let's start with what you've done. Tell us about how your own work experiences got you into this topic.
Sure. The long story, which I'll make short, is probably similar to many. I did not, in my 20s, even in my teens, I wasn't looking to do something that I guess quickly identified by a title or led a specific place. I was looking for meaningful activity in the moment. It's rarely the case that what you're looking for when you're looking for something meaningful and enjoyable, that it's also going to pay or that it's going to lead in a particular direction or
right.
a particularly secure direction. So, my first job was freshman in high school working at a music and video rental store where I lived in Chicago, and I was delighted at the end of the six-hour Sunday shift I worked to get $36 under the counter, $6 an hour in cash. It was a beautiful thing to walk down the street with that money and know that I had earned it. But from there, I think not until my late 30s did I take a full-time job, and that was deliberate. That was a kind of deliberate effort to do only things that felt that they were both satisfying for me while I did them and in some way good for other people or the world around me to the extent that I understood that. And emphasizing those two rarely seemed to fit well with things like security for my family or long-term buildup of accounts, that sort of thing. Yeah.
So you're in your late 30s before you settle down, so to speak. What kinds of things were you doing? You mentioned two categories there, being good for humanity and being stimulating for you. How did you hit those points, and what other kinds of jobs met the mark?
Well, some weren't jobs, and I thought of them as joblets, little jobs.
Joblets.
Joblets. I had four joblets, and I would sustain these joblets. One was teaching in non-traditional places. One was starting a nonprofit for underserved young people. One was working to do something like what I'm doing now, which is getting people talking about tough questions. And then I was waiting tables to also get through grad school at the time. So, grad school is an interesting thing to think about where in some way it's a job, but you're also a student. It's a little bit of both. You're not sure what it is. Then at a certain point, you're supposed to mature out of it, finish, get your certificate, and become part of the productive workforce. So at some point, things in my life changed enough that that I took that step. To the extent that it's productive is not for me to determine, but I at least have to be at the same office with a regular salary at this point going forward, which is both a fortunate development and a shift.
Do you remember what it felt like, when you were, say, in your 20s and you had these, I love that word, joblets, and someone would ask you that really ubiquitous question that they often ask right away on meeting a new person, what do you do? And your answer would be sort of long and philosophical, it sounds like. Do you remember what it felt like to try and answer that to someone who was basically just sort of checking off a platitude when they asked you?
Sure. In fact, it's not so different answering now because my work is strange enough that no matter who asks, I can't give a good short answer. And so instead, I've learned to really enjoy the look of befuddlement that comes across people's faces when they try to, they try to figure out who is this person, which is what does this person do? And if it's at all not fitting nicely, it becomes become sort of interesting. And so I remember the feeling of going, huh, this person has no idea what I'm doing. And then most of the time what that means is a kind of nod and a polite smile and then moving on. Sometimes you get the kind of questions that go deeper.
Well, let's shoot for some of those today and possibly delve into those looks of befuddlement. So what do you do, Adam, for you're the executive director at Oregon Humanities, and what does that entail, and what's the organization all about?
Yeah, well, it's funny, at the beginning of the introduction, you said jefe, and that was nice. That's nice shorthand, and not one I'd ever choose myself, but kind of good. Oregon Humanities is a nonprofit, which is a funny way to describe an outfit, because it's essentially a tax category. It doesn't tell you much, but what we exist for is we try to get people talking about hard questions all around the state, and especially to be talking with each other across differences, whether it's differences of geography, race, education, class, opinion. So the way we think of our work is we're trying to strengthen community by getting people talking about shared issues. And so it's a funny kind of work for an organization in that it's not physical work, so it's not direct service exactly, but we are trying to strengthen community in ways that are especially detectable to people that experience it and often a little bit difficult to explain.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Adam Davis. He is the executive director at Oregon Humanities, which puts on the Conversation Project across the state. These are gatherings to get people, as Adam put it, talking about tough questions. That tough question today is, what do you do? Please join this discussion with your stories of what you do or what it feels like to be asked that. 800-838-3760, or you can drop an email off, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Adam, I tried to put the Conversation Project in a nutshell just now. Did I do a good job? Is that about cover it?
You did pretty well. Yeah. I mean, we have right now about 25 different topics. Any organization around the state can request any one of those. And then Oregon Humanities will send a trained discussion leader out who will lead that discussion with the community that the local organization has brought in. And I should say we're in the process of adding about 15 new conversation projects to the catalog. Those will be available in the fall. But we've been doing it for about 7 years and reached, you know, many thousands of people. And it's really just interesting to think of what's the impact, what's the work that this kind of activity gets done over the years, both for the people that are getting together and talking and for the people whose work it is to prepare and lead those conversations, usually on top of their other jobs.
And you had one coming up this week, actually, in Cottage Grove, but it was recently rescheduled. It'll now be on July 28th at Hard Knocks Brewing. They're on Main Street in Cottage Grove, talking about what do you do, and what does that say about you and about society more generally? Adam, is this topic a regular of the Conversation Project catalog? Have you done it before?
Yeah, I've done it a few times. I also lead two others. One is called What We Want from the Wild, and one is From Saving to Serving on Intervening in the Lives of Others. All three of them are trying to get at questions that are really central to, I think, the lives of Oregonians, and not only Oregonians.
Let's focus on the what do you do topic. How long have you done it? How many years? And what's been your takeaways there?
Yeah, in this context, with this title, probably about a year and a half now. And I think that, you know, takeaways are similar to takeaways in other conversation projects, which is when you talk about kind of the central activities in our lives, there are people come at it from lots of different places. So, for example, we're lucky to have work in many cases. And at the same time, we can feel a real strong resentment of our work. We can be delighted when Friday comes around. There's nothing that feels as good as quitting a job. At the same time, you know, we feel grateful to have work. It's a real mark of maturity and adulthood to get that first real-sounding job, and then you struggle to keep it, to improve in it. And as you said at the introduction, it's often how we identify ourselves. So what we do for work ends up being, in many ways, who we are, both to other people and probably to some extent to ourselves.
So what kinds of questions do you throw out there, or do you ask people to entertain in order to try to get at the meaning of all this rather than just the labels for it?
Sure. I mean, I use some images. We look at both a couple photographs and some images of people, everything from child labor to kind of traditional agricultural work. just trying to get at what people associate with different images of work. And then we spend some time often looking at a short poem, this beautiful Gary Soto poem called A Red Palm, which focuses on one guy doing some work and what it means both for him and for his family. So those are ways, really, rather than me saying through some statistical approach or something like that, I'm just trying to put some prompts in front of people and get them talking to each other and reflecting on where work sits for them.
Have you been surprised by people's reactions to these prompts?
Yeah, I think there's two kinds of surprise. One is the substance of their responses, and the other is just, I think sometimes people themselves are surprised by what they're saying or what they're feeling, and that always feels fresh, even if what they're saying is something that I've heard in another conversation in another part of the state. It's very much about the specific people and the way they're coming to terms with what they're thinking about.
Do you ever uncover anxiety in these sessions where maybe people weren't even aware they had so much of it relating to their working life?
I would say both uncover it and in some cases really try to provoke it, to do it in a place that, where it feels comfortable. But, you know, when you're getting people thinking and talking, anxiety can be a helpful spur. I don't mean that in a troublesome way once you get out of the room, but, reflection should be a little bit anxious. We're thinking about what we do and why we do it, and there are lots of other things we could be doing. So anxiety is almost a necessary part of it. And then when you add that to the economic anxiety or the question of self-worth that's wrapped up in jobs, then absolutely there can be some anxiety in the room, and that's why it's good sometimes to have humor in the room as well.
Oh, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Adam Davis. He's the executive director of Oregon Humanities and leading a talk about working life and what we can draw from that on these tough questions of more existential questions than what do you do, how you are, and who you want to be. Let's go to a call, Adam. We've got Mark in Reading on the line. Mark, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
For years, when people ask me, what do you do, I would tell them as little as possible, which is a line used by Jack Nicholson, written by Robert Towne, I imagine, in the movie Chinatown. But it was a great way to get people to think about something other than my employment or anything of that nature.
Yeah, it's a good line. And, the interesting thing is the question of what we work for. And for many people, we work so that we can spend our most meaningful time not working. So, you know, that response seems to point in that direction. We work so we can play, or we work so we can relax, something like that.
Well, and that brings us to a vein I really wanted to get into with you, Adam, which is the difference between a job and a calling. I think we've all felt that, unless we're very, very, very lucky. Have you gotten to that with people in your sessions? And, you know, how do you see the disconnect that so many people have in their lives between what they do for money and what they do for love affecting society as a whole or even just that individual?
Sure. We often end up talking about job, career, and calling, and the way the three do or don't overlap, or where they do or don't overlap. And there's no question that they can feel like very personal questions that are all about the individual, but they're deeply related to the way our society is structured. And you can imagine all sorts of other structures, and we can even see plenty where people are wouldn't sort neatly into one of those three categories and wouldn't, in a way, have to think about, I guess, subsistence through some activity that pays them a certain wage. So that's completely the direction we try to end up moving and usually do.
Got another call here. Ryan in Eugene is on the line. I think he's going to keep us in this vein. He's also on the line with the sticky button. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to The Exchange.
Well, good morning. Yeah, a fascinating conversation. You know, who are we, and based on what we do, our productivity into the economy is certainly part of that. I'm about ready to do a workshop today on forging a community of practice, bringing a bunch of people together with a variety of jobs and hats that they've come to the table. And I'm really thinking about, I love that advocating for? What kinds of qualities do you want? All of those other characteristics, because I see that as part of that community definition. But there's also that practice, and not practices in trying to hit a ball, but practices in more like a doctor's practice,
right.
And so some insight would be really helpful for me, or how you frame this.
Thanks, Ryan. Thoughts on that one, Adam?
Yeah, I wish I could offer insight. And I'm better at trying to provoke it than deliver it. I mean, I think, I think back to Aristotle, weirdly, when you're talking about the word praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, the way it gets transliterated, and kind of thinking about practical philosophy. How do you get action and what you're thinking, so what we do and what we think about in the world, to line up well? For Aristotle, at least, it has a lot to do with what we do it for. And so every activity in the world points toward usually a certain other, larger, more important activity that it serves. And you can keep going. You can look at anything we do and go, well, we do that because of this. We make a shoe because we want to keep our feet shod while we're out working. Why do we want to do that? And, you know, where he ends up going is toward happiness, that's the reason we do the work and the other things we do in the world. And I guess while thinking about the Greeks, it's also worth thinking about the relationship between work and leisure for them, which was very different than it is for us. So not insight, but at least I think your question, Ryan, provokes for me lots of other questions.
I want to touch on those cultural differences, perhaps a greater rift between modern American society and ancient Greece than modern American society and, say, European society or Latin American. What are other cultures like in this regard? Is that part of your research into this inquiry?
Yeah, I mean, I would say very cursory research shows that we work more, that in the United States we put in more hours weekly and yearly than most sort of, I guess, modernized Western capitalist, avowedly democratic countries. But that's an interesting thing, because we're pretty productive, and it's interesting that productivity seems to generate the urge for more productivity. I should say that the Conversation Project on work that I lead is not heavily rooted in statistics. It's beginning with enough statistics to, I think, validate the sense that a lot of people say they're busy a lot of the time, and often that's because they're working, sometimes by choice and sometimes by necessity. But that's really the jumping off point. And then to think about why is that the case. The comparative examples are really helpful, because even within the structure where a lot of people work, we can think about choices, for example, thinking about when people leave the workforce. So in some cases, parents, that decision is a real reflection of competing values and saying, well, you know what, it's not worth it to me anymore. And if I have the capacity to choose other things, I will. And that, again, up against plenty of folks who really feel like, and for good reason, necessity drives the choice, and not just one job but three jobs.
Right. That word choice you just used, I sort of wrote it down and circled it a bunch of times, because it seems like in the course of doing work like this, getting people to ask themselves and each other questions about work, you would reveal some very different experiences according to, you know, your class, your gender, your race. Is that something that comes up in these sessions, and does it get?
Absolutely.
Well, how does it go?
I mean, this, you know, you talked about, well, first of all, different perspectives are key to any conversation project, whatever the theme happens to be. Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, we can get locked into thinking that everyone else's situation is much like ours. And when we start thinking about work, that's when you start to get that blown to pieces in what I think is a really helpful way. And so when you think about our live political questions, the more we're able to factor in the real conditions that govern how many people subsist in the world, the more likely it is that we're going to be thinking in ways we wouldn't otherwise think. And that strikes me as a good thing and a necessary thing for the kind of political arrangement we have in this country.
Are the people that come together for these conversations generally strangers? Do they tend to actually represent the differences that would create the most robust conversation or diverse conversation?
You know, one of the nice things about the Conversation Project is it's hard to answer generally, because there's real variety based on whether the Conversation Project is happening in Klamath Falls or in North Portland or in Pendleton. So you get a real you could take the same framework for a conversation and the same topic And then depending on where it is, the people it draws and the directions it goes will be different. But we do see a real wide swath of Oregonians participating in these.
Just about a minute left here with Adam Davis, the director of Oregon Humanities, and today philosopher of What Our Work Says About Us. Let's get a call in from Rick in Eugene. Rick, welcome to the exchange.
Hello. I'm curious what your guest thinks of the following. You know, our species has been here on the planet apparently for somewhere between 100 and 250,000 years in our current form. The majority of that time, we had not domesticated plants and animals yet. We were living wild, like animals, really, you know. And what we think of as work didn't really come into being until we domesticated plants and animals 10,000 years ago or so and gradually developed surpluses of food, and city-states began to emerge and specialization began to emerge. And our work...
All right, Rick, your question?
You know, today is new.
Yeah, I think I hear a question about work having developed recently and that it may be distinctive to human beings. And does that sound like the question you're going towards?
Yeah, that and others, how much evolution takes place sometimes very slowly, and I don't know whether we've evolved quickly enough to adapt to the society we've created.
Good one. Thank you for that, Rick. And there's about a minute left to answer, Adam, so shoot high.
Yeah, two kinds of answers. One, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but it is interesting that necessity seems to drive the way we think about work. And even as we develop all sorts of things that are intended to make our lives easier, the push of necessity doesn't seem to move away as much as it might. I say that sitting in an air-conditioned office with lights overhead, so some things are obviously working, and yet I'm here from early till late. Second thing I'd say to that quickly with species in mind is that when I watch my dog sleeping in sunlight in the afternoon, I envy that dog. He is rarely at work.
Right, not preoccupied at all. Adam Davis has been our guest. He's director of Oregon Humanities. The topic, what do you do and what does it say about you? He's leading a talk at July 28th at Hard Knocks Brewery in Cottage Grove. Thank you for being here, Adam.
Thanks a lot, Emily. Appreciate the conversation.